The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, The Making of a Foodie Town. James Beard Award finalists chronicle their journeys with hopes of changing the Triangle's restaurant scene. And the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, The Making of a Foodie Town, Three Decades of Change Through the Lens of the Triangle's Restaurant Scene, written by Laura Bromette. When the Red Hot Chili Peppers left Raleigh's Walnut Creek Amphitheater stage after the second Lollapalooza Music Festival in 1992, their post-performance meal options were limited in a city of only about 220,000 people. It was a vastly smaller market. The Red Hat software company then consisted of one man, Mark Ewing, hacking and burning Linux disks out of his Raleigh home. Back then, downtown Raleigh fell quiet after 6 p.m. In fact, the city was so determined to have an upscale restaurant downtown that it pitched in $1 million to help launch The Mint in 2008, but it closed after 4 years. But now the population of Raleigh has surged to 470,000 as life sciences and technology companies boom and the city attracts people seeking a high quality of life with fair weather and a reasonable cost of living. And as Raleigh's reputation has grown, local chefs believe the city's restaurant offerings are rising to match it as a scene once compromising simple Southern foods will continue to elevate, building on breakthrough chefs such as Ashley Christensen and Chidi Kumar. It's a palate that's rapidly evolving, a market still in love with sweet tea and barbecue, but fascinated by and supportive of a rising culinary scene. The story of Southern food is being expressed in the most creative and exciting way by people who aren't necessarily from here but have chosen to make this their home, says Kumar, who grew up in India and New York. We're creating this thread between the past, the present, and the future. Kumar was recently named as a finalist for this year's James Beard Awards, one of the most prestigious nominations in the industry. In the 30 years that the James Beard Foundation has given out awards, only a handful have landed in the Triangle. This year, the region had 6 representatives on the semifinal list, with 3 making it to the final round. Semifinalists include Sonny Gerhardt of St. Roque Fine Oysters and Bar, Oscar Diaz of the Cortez, and Aaron Vandemark of Panchudo. Kumar, Ricky Moore of Saltbox Seafood, and Allen 26, owned by Shannon Healy, advanced to the final round. Winners will be announced at a ceremony held on June 13. The recognition comes as newcomers are moving to the area in droves from larger cities like New York, where culinary excellence is expected. Though not yet deemed a foodie town by those standards, the Triangle may be trending that way. One indication of how the food scene has grown is the rise in spending in the market on food and beverage. In just 10 years, Wake County's yearly food and beverage tax collection amount has grown by more than $10 million. The tax, comprised of 1% of the sale price of prepared food and beverages, amounted to $17.77 million in fiscal year 2010 to 2011 and surged to $28.33 million by the 20 to 21 period. And despite the current challenges faced by restaurants with rising costs and a struggle to hire, the restaurant scene is booming. So far this year, from January to April, the tax collection amount has already hit $30.45 million, a testament to the area's growing interest in food and beverage options. Raleigh's humble beginnings. When Kevin and Stacy Jennings moved to Raleigh in the late 1990s, the restaurant scene was bleak. The type of restaurant that the pair was looking to open didn't exist in the area. If someone was looking for a nice sit-down meal, the Angus Barn, Glenwood Grill, and Cafe Luna were some of the only options, Kevin Jennings says. So in 1998, they opened Frazier's on Hillsborough Street. Frazier's was a cool little spot. A lot of people felt like it was not a Raleigh kind of thing, he says. People coming in would say, I feel like I'm in a little place in New York. The Jennings had previously lived in Atlanta and Charleston, South Carolina, places more accustomed to culinary flair. They were aiming to bring a more elevated dining experience to Raleigh. Frazier's has closed, but now the Jennings own Urban Food Group with three popular Raleigh restaurants, three Wilmington locations, one in Charlotte, and even one in Denver. Raleigh's Chow, Coquette, and Vivace are all under the brand. Vivace opened in 2005 with a priority on interior design. Stacy Jennings says, the Tuscan-inspired Trattoria, located in North Hills, offered an overall package for diners, not just good food. That trend was already popular in bigger cities, but was new to the Raleigh area, she says. There was no downtown like it is today. There wasn't a Glenwood South. There was no real North Hills, Kevin Jennings says. We feel like we're very fortunate to have come into Raleigh, the Raleigh market at that time and opened a restaurant in our vein of the industry. In Durham and Chapel Hill, those elevated experience restaurants were more established. Crook's Corner, which opened at the end of the West Franklin Street in 1982, was featured in the New York Times in 1985 in a story naming Chef Bill Neal as one of the finest young Southern chefs. The article dove into Neal's passion for Southern food, thought by many to be unsophisticated, and the refinements he made to common and traditional dishes. His recipe for shrimp and grits was included in the story, a dish that at that time was not likely to be found on menus in upscale establishments. Shrimp and grits are now a Southern restaurant staple. When Neal died in 1991, Bill Smith joined the restaurant to lead the kitchen. Smith and Gene Hammer, who had opened Crook's Corner along with Neal, kept Neal's legacy alive until the two retired in 2019. The restaurant is now owned by Healy, owner of Durham Bar, Alley 26, and former bar manager at Crook's. Crook's Corner closed during the pandemic, but isn't gone for good. Healy is working on renovating the interior and hopes to restore it to its former glory. Though Durham did have high-end hospitality experiences in the form of restaurants, such as the much-loved Nana's, downtown Durham was a food and beverage ghost town at the time. People weren't walking around downtown back then. Now there are a lot of things to do, but there was nothing at that point, Healy says. We opened early, one could argue too early, but I'm happy to be a small little part of that transformation. An evolving customer base. Compared to what Kumar discovered upon moving to the area in the 1990s, downtown Raleigh has been transformed. Garland, Kumar's restaurant, featuring Indian and Asian dishes with a Southern touch, is now one of several unique food and beverage establishments downtown. Christensen opened Pool's Diner in 2007, and that had a domino effect with spots such as St. Roque Fine Oysters and Bar, Fiction Kitchen, and Centro Mexican Restaurant becoming local favorites. Over the course of the last two decades, Raleigh has become this unlikely place of women and immigrants and people that aren't really corporate forces, Kumar says. They're just individuals who have taken a chance on a spot in downtown and put their entire life behind expressing themselves through their food. For these creative concepts to be successful in downtown Raleigh, customer demand had to shift as well. Ordering a $20 entree at a casual weeknight dinner is a jump from the typical picking up a $5 hamburger on the way home from work. Along with locals adjusting, the demographic makeup of Raleigh has changed, Kumar says. People now have more of an open mind about foreign cuisines and are seeking an experience when they dine out instead of a quick bite to eat. A restaurant like mine would have been a lot more successful in a bigger city, Kumar says, but at the same time, I'm always surprised by how adventurous people can be. Helping make that adjustment easier is the presence of Southern influence in these restaurants. Garland serves pan-seared Carolina trout, common in regional restaurants, but adds a South Asian spice blend and tomato chutney to the dish. Downtown Raleigh restaurant Fiction Kitchen also takes a non-Southern concept, vegan cooking, and marries it with tradition. The all-vegan restaurant's menu includes fried pimento cheese, fried chicken, and macaroni and cheese. The James Beard Award nominations and finalists are tangible results of the rising recognition for the Triangle's restaurants. Just 10 years ago, having three James Beard Award finalists hailing from the Triangle area would have been impossible. The talent was present, but the industry was a different ballgame, Moore says. Deserving people are finally being recognized, says Durham's Moore, who opened Saltbox Seafood Joint in 2012. The Triangle doesn't have to abandon its roots to become a gastronomic mecca. Saltbox Seafood's Moore says he focuses on fried North Carolina seafood being prepared simple and straightforward. Regionally, we're known for barbecue, but man, we're more than that, he says. There's beautiful food being cooked in this market with diverse interpretations, but still rooted in our regional foodstuffs. We have a culinary identity. That's worthy of notice. a risky business. Appealing to the Triangle's customer base isn't the only hurdle that restaurateurs face when deciding to open a new concept. If a restaurateur wants to open a well-thought-out concept in downtown Raleigh, they'll need financing. Restaurants have historically been deemed as risky investments, and the volatility of the industry experienced due to the pandemic didn't help their case. Most restaurants are in leased spaces, leaving owners with little collateral beyond restaurant equipment, a factor difficult for many banks to wrap their heads around, says Stuart Patch, regional president at Dogwood State Bank. Most obtain Small Business Administration loans through local banks. Dogwood State Bank has about a dozen restaurant customers, Patch says. When looking at applications from restaurant owners or groups, the bank takes into account the track record of the applicant, the planned location, and the concept itself. An established restaurant group will likely have a smoother time securing finances for a new concept than a first-time owner. One of the things that can make it easier for us is if there are existing restaurants under their umbrella that are already producing cash flow, Patch says. If there's a proven cash flow stream beyond just a new startup restaurant, that can always mitigate a lot of risk. In terms of concepts, investing in fast casual spots with low per-plate pricing is a bit easier for banks to swallow. Those are usually deemed less risky than high-end restaurants, Patch says, though Dogwood State Bank tends to focus more on the applicant themselves. Amber Mashakos, president of LM Restaurants, remembers her parents facing that challenge when starting the company 40 years ago. The industry has always been perceived as risky, she says. There's a low barrier to entry with a high failure rate. The banks look at us as being risky operations, Mashako says. If you don't know what you're doing or you don't understand the magic that goes into the hospitality industry, it's very easy to fail. But to her, the potential rewards from opening a unique concept are worth the risk. The Raleigh-based restaurant group is behind downtown Raleigh favorites Taverna Agora and Vidrio, along with the Carolina Ale House brand. Among LM Restaurant's other holdings is the Oceanic Restaurant in Wilmington. Along with Top Chef alum Katsuchi Tanabe, LM Restaurants recently opened a new restaurant with a unique concept. In a 5,500-square-foot space in Cary, a Verde Cochina and Tequila Library serves elevated Mexican dishes with a dash of Japanese influence. The restaurant is located near Crossroads Plaza in a shopping center featuring Red Robin Gourmet Burgers, Panera Bread, and LM Restaurant's Carolina Ale House. The building was already owned by the restaurant group and previously housed Wild Wing Cafe. We had to consider, are people in the suburban market ready for more of a downtown experience, Mashako says. The cuisine is elevated, the music is a bit louder, everything's a little edgier, but restaurant operators like a challenge. But in this era of a tight labor market with high inflation, Mashako's current chair for the board of directors of the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association is well aware of the challenges for an industry that operates on thin margins. Already, the Circus restaurant in Raleigh has announced it will close after 48 years because it can't find staff. Those mom-and-pop restaurants, are they going to be able to survive? Are they going to be able to weather this crisis that we're facing? Mashako says. I really hope that they do because having a healthy restaurant community, it's good for community overall. I don't want to see restaurants fail. To the suburbs and beyond. Before moving to the Triangle, Tanabe cooked across Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York. He worked inside some of the country's most acclaimed restaurants and started a first-of-its-kind authentic kosher Mexican restaurant. Tanabe landed in Raleigh after looking for somewhere with a better quality of life, with more greenery and space to raise a family. He opened a restaurant, High Horse, in City Market in 2019, quickly making a mark on the local community, but complications related to the pandemic caused the restaurant to close in 2020. LM Restaurants then brought Tanabe on as the chef in residence, and he later transitioned to full-time culinary innovator for the group in the fall of 2021. The Averde concept was born from Tanabe's own ethnic background. One of his parents is Mexican and the other is Japanese. Tanabe himself grew up in Mexico before moving to the United States at age 18. The restaurant features dishes from his childhood while also incorporating his Japanese background. Averde's interior design, equally as impactful as its food, was done with the help from famed local restaurateur Georgios Bakatsias. Colorful murals adorn the walls, modern light fixtures illuminate each table, and a loud mix of music, including songs like Milkshake by Kellis, fills the space. The experience is unlike anything found at other restaurants in the area. With that uniqueness comes the risk of local customers not responding to the concept. If I were to open this in Chicago or Los Angeles, people would understand the concept, Tanabe says. Before I opened, I was like, am I taking a risk? Am I going to fail? Am I going to be the outsider trying to bring something that people are not used to? Averti has now been open just over 2 months, and 90% of its customers have been extremely pleased, Tanabe says. The other 10% isn't happy with the loud music or is expecting a typical Mexican restaurant like others nearby. To Tanabe, the response has been a success. When the restaurants at Carey's new Fenton development open, Dotan Zuckerman, vice president of leasing for Columbia Development, is hoping to garner a similar response. The 69-acre mixed-use development is situated along Interstate 40 and Carytown Boulevard. Its first retail tenants are scheduled to open the weekend of June 4 through 5. But Fenton will eventually include a hotel, hundreds of apartments, and office space. What the development will not include is national food chains and beverage brands like Panera Bread or Starbucks, both of which have an established presence in Cary. Instead, Zuckerman sought out to curate a unique and creative mix of concepts from local and critically acclaimed chefs. Steve Palmer, a James Beard Award-nominated chef from Charleston, South Carolina, will open an Italian concept called Coletta. His hospitality group, the Indigo Road Hospitality Group, is behind Raleigh's Oak Steakhouse and Oku Sushi. Another James Beard Award nominee, Georgia-based chef Ford Fry, is bringing his Tex-Mex concept, Superica. Raleigh chef Scott Crawford was one of Fenton's first signed tenants and will open Crawford Brothers Steakhouse there. Local favorite, Drom and Drought, with locations in Raleigh, Greensboro, Durham, and Wilmington, will be opening a whiskey bar in the development. Chef Mike Lee, owner of Durham's M Restaurants, is bringing a location of M Sushi. The people that we want to attract are kind of over the Applebee's, Chili's, Cheesecake Factory, Five Guys types of places. They're everywhere. There's nothing special about them, Zuckerman says. It's about having a good understanding of what the people want. Zuckerman had already built a relationship with Fry and Palmer from working on other projects together. When he approached the chefs about coming to Fenton, it took a bit of education about the market. After several visits and market tours, they saw the massive growth happening in the Triangle and wanted to be a part of it, Zuckerman says. As the Triangle grows, Tanabe will be ready to open another restaurant, potentially leaning toward the Japanese side. Whatever is happening elsewhere in the country will happen in Raleigh. I think we're just going to do it at a different speed and in the style of the area, Tanabe says. This place is going to grow wildly in the next few years. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Local shops highlighted in U.S. Women's Open. If you look closely, the U.S. Women's Open coming to Southern Pines is not always about good golf, as American Express sees it as an opportunity to showcase some of its small business cardholders in the Southern Pines area. The financial services company teamed up with six well-known LPGA golfers and paid them to don logos and signage of six Sandhills women-owned retail shops on their visors, caps, sleeves, and golf bags. Among the businesses that will benefit from Amex's actions include Cooper & Bailey's, a women's boutique, High Octane, a coffee shop. Cooper & Bailey's will be on Lexi Thompson's driver cover. High Octane, the coffee shop, will be on the side of the hat for Lydia Ko. C-Cup's Cupcakery, a bakery, will be on Celine Boutier's left sleeve. Twig & Company, seller of handmade goods from local artisans, Gabby Lopez, right collar. Morgan Miller, women's clothing store, Stacy Lewis, right chest. And home decor shop, Eloise Trading Company, Rose Zhang, golf bag. Megan Davis started Cooper & Bailey's as an e-commerce business after graduating from NC State University in 2013, and with her mother Debbie as part owner, grew it into a brick-and-mortar business in the village of Pinehurst. She says she at first thought the American Express offer was not real. Her store has always accepted American Express cards and used the company for business purposes as well. Our logo being with Lexi was just a phone call, she says. They were featuring women-owned small businesses, and they said they'd like for Cooper & Bailey's to be a part of it. I was like, whoa, that's kind of a big deal. Amex in a statement says, We wanted to represent a wide range of merchants in the Southern Pines area. We know how important small businesses are to local communities everywhere, and we know that these six represent some of the various and unique offerings Southern Pines has to offer to both residents and travelers in town for the open. Foundry lands real estate veteran from the Fallon Company. A real estate veteran who was leading the Fallon Company's efforts in the Triangle has a new job. Zach Von Cannon, who served as Fallon's managing director, has moved to Foundry Commercial. Von Cannon, who is from North Carolina and played tennis at Washington and Lee University, gave Boston-based Fallon a local presence as it built its Raleigh Crossing project, which is now home to Pendo. Fallon bought the property in 2018, and the Pendo Tower was the start of a planned two-tower development. Von Cannon has joined Foundry as a managing director for development and investments. Foundry is headquartered in Orlando, Florida, but has a large presence in North Carolina, especially in the Triangle and Charlotte. Von Cannon says he'll be working to execute on opportunities across all asset classes. Fallon, meanwhile, says it remains committed to its project and plans to move ahead with Phase 2. Crook's Corner offers fans a treat. Crook's Corner is back open, well, sort of. The legendary Chapel Hill Eatery will sell its beloved Honeysuckle Sorbet June 3rd from noon to 4 p.m. The restaurant, which has been closed since June 2021, is anticipating reopening this year. Shannon Healy, an owner of the Franklin Street spot since 2018, says he's working on renovating the inside of the building with plans to reopen the restaurant. Bill Smith introduced the Honeysuckle Sorbet when he served as executive chef at Crook's Corner. If you grew up with honeysuckle, a taste of the sorbet is a mind-bending experience. You can watch people's faces when they taste it and see their reactions of pure delight and nostalgia, Healy says. Rex Open makes last run at TPC. It's the last run this weekend for the Rex Hospital Open at its home for 18 years at TPC Wakefield as the tournament moves to Raleigh Country Club next year. Both clubs are owned by McConnell Golf. The tournament, part of the Corn Ferry Tour, has long been a showcase for local talent, and this year includes Ben Griffin, UNC Chapel Hill, Stephen Franken, Raleigh native who played at NC State University, and Albin Choi, NC State. The four-day charity tournament raises money for patient care and services and runs through June 5. The tournament has raised more than $10 million over three decades. Admission, covered by Drive Shack, is free. Proceeds this year will support the UNC Rex Mobile Mammography Program. The total purse is $750,000, with the winner earning $135,000. Carmaker strikes a deal with Intel. Vingroup, the Vietnamese conglomerate over electric car maker VinFast, has a new partner, Intel. The firms have signed an agreement to develop advanced technologies, and it comes just months after VinFast announced plans for a 7,500-job car assembly operation in Chatham County. Part of the deal has the companies collaborating around creating and deploying smart factory IoT solutions, Internet of Things, for VinES batteries manufacturing and VinFast electric vehicles manufacturing. A company spokesman declined to comment on what the deal could mean for the Chatham County operation. And finally, we have a section called He Said It with a quote from Peter Hans, UNC System President, on adopting a new regulation intended to help military students receive the appropriate credit for their previous training. In the past, we have missed out on the chance to serve talented military students because our credit policies weren't easy to parse or weren't as generous as those of our peers. Hundreds of faculty and administrators have worked to correct that problem. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to 52 Shades of Success, the continuing stories. The headline, Building Positive Energy. Aaron Thomas has leaned into his Lumbee heritage and knowledge of energy efficiency to grow his now $150 million construction firm. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ+ community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project also will delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. Beyond the construction industry, education and economic development are passions that run deep for Aaron Thomas, in large part because his perspective is measured by generations and his values are driven by his Lumbee heritage. In American Indian culture, we are not just looking at what happens today, but at how we prepare for the next seven generations, says Thomas, who founded Metcon in 1999 in his hometown of Pembroke, where the tribe is headquartered. Most of the roughly 60,000 Lumbee members live within a 25-mile radius of the town. Metcon, with company-wide revenue of more than $150 million and more than 800 projects across the Carolinas and offices in Raleigh and Charlotte, has completed over 100 projects on the UNC Pembroke campus, spanning new construction, renovations, and infrastructure. The company reported $50 million in triangle gross billings in 2020. For Thomas, the recently completed Thomas Hall School of Business at UNC Pembroke stands out in his mind not only because it further positions the university and its graduates to lead businesses and economic development, but also because the building is designed to be energy positive, meaning it has the potential to produce more energy than it uses. Thomas Hall is named for James Thomas, a prominent real estate developer in Los Angeles who is a strong supporter of UNC Pembroke and also a distant cousin of Aaron Thomas. While the $38 million facility is new, business education has always been a core area, and the designated American Indian University will award 600 MBA degrees to graduates this academic year. One of the reasons sustainability is important to us is because of our Native American heritage and that we always talk about the next seven generations. For us, buildings that create value not only from a financial standpoint but also to help protect the environment are a win-win, he says. The School of Business at UNC Pembroke is their first energy-positive facility in the UNC system, although they have done 13 such buildings in the Carolinas. About 70% of Metcon's work is government-related in higher education, and the company has worked on university campuses across the Carolinas, including three resident halls on the NC Central University campus that totaled roughly $96 million, the company's largest triangle project to date. We do a lot of K-12 schools as well as other government-related buildings for counties and municipalities, Thomas says. Most of the 13 energy-positive buildings we've done at our schools, most recently the Jones County K-12 school in eastern North Carolina that generates up to 50% more power than it consumes. The $47 million Jones County School consolidated elementary, middle, and high school students into a three-wing, 125,000-square-foot campus that saves energy by using geothermal well field heat pumps, LED lighting, high-performance lighting and glass, a superior building envelope, natural daylight, and over 100,000 square feet of solar panels. The energy-positive buildings have been very unique projects that provide a lot of value, he explains, adding that not only are they highly sustainable, making them more cost-efficient to operate, they also have the option of selling energy back to the grid. We run an energy model to tabulate what the cost is if we do a building the regular way compared to what it costs if we build in the additional things needed, and we're finding it costs about 15% more to be energy-positive. As adoption of EV grows, the upside potential of energy-positive buildings expands. One of the school projects we've been working on is talking about using that excess energy to charge school buses, Thomas says. Like all businesses, the challenges he's facing are supply chain disruptions and labor shortages. It's extremely difficult to get certain materials and lead times that used to be 2 months can now be 10 months or longer, Thomas says. On every building, we have to examine details across the supply chain, look at the inflationary impacts, and in some cases suggest alternate materials that could reduce costs or that we could get within the time constraints of the project. For required materials like fire alarm systems and generators, he's looking to order a year ahead of when they're needed. Every project is impacted in some way, and products that include computer chips are among the hardest to source. Demand for semiconductors grew 17% from 2019 to 2021, according to the U.S. Commerce Department, but the median inventory on hand at manufacturers fell from a 40-day supply to less than a 5-day supply across that same period. And the Commerce Department survey revealed little bandwidth to grow supply, with the majority of fabrication plants already at 90% of their capacity to manufacture chips. From solar panels to generators to emergency systems, many critical construction materials require computer chips, putting companies like Metcon at a serious disadvantage. The majority of what we build has to have a generator to provide backup power for life safety systems, and those generators have computer chips for the control boards, Thomas says. The biggest issue is being able to lock in prices. For the first time since I've been in business, manufacturers are telling subcontractors in certain trades that they can't lock in a price. This creates a lot of risk for the general contractors and for the subcontractors. The labor market is also the tightest he's seen in his 22 years of running the business. We try to make sure our folks are well compensated, and we also try to educate folks on the fact that we've never had a layoff, even going through recessions. We have a record of taking care of our team in good times and in bad times. In its monthly report on construction employment, the Associated General Contractors of America said that the number of people working in construction in North Carolina is up 1.7% from 234,300 in February 2020 to 238,300 in April 2022. But on the hiring end, there's a shortfall. All of the subcontractors say they don't have enough manpower, and they're having a hard time recruiting folks, so the wages are rising, Thomas says. I spend a lot of time working with school systems and going to schools, even elementary schools, to tell kids about careers and trades and construction, especially in some of the more rural parts of the state where we have a lot of kids from lesser means and a lot of minority kids. There are untapped opportunities in that workforce development area. If North Carolina is going to continue to have big industry wins and housing and buildings that can keep pace with that economic development, we have to reach back and bring our kids into these workforce areas. Thomas is the co-developer of the City Gateway mixed-use development in downtown Raleigh. Construction on the project is a joint venture between Metcon and Clancy & Fays. The first phase of the 7-acre site is underway with a 288-unit multifamily component. And we also have two shorter news stories in the 52 Shades of Success section. $11.6 million approved for school workforce program. The NC State Board of Community Colleges has allocated $11.6 million to establish and expand apprenticeship opportunities for students 16 to 25 years old. The goal is to increase participation among underserved populations and encourage education, training, and workforce skills that meet the needs of employers. The funding will provide opportunities for small businesses located in Tier 1 and Tier 2 counties to build talent pipelines by bringing on new apprentices in high-demand trades or careers. Employers with qualifying apprentices will receive up to $2,000 per apprentice for onboarding and training, plus a 50% salary reimbursement on wages up to $15 per hour for non-high school students and $14 per hour for high school students. Colleges will receive up to $2,500 per apprentice for tuition, books, fees, and supplies. The funds will be available July 1, 2022 through December 31, 2024. And finally, DOE slates $40 million for a minority education initiative. The U.S. Department of Energy announced $40 million to fund its Renew project called Reaching a New Energy Sciences Workforce. The Renew initiative will provide research opportunities for historically underrepresented groups to pursue STEM education and training or internships in physical and climate sciences. Beneficiaries will include historically black colleges and universities, minority-serving institutions, and research institutions. Areas of focus will include quantum computing, basic energy sciences, biological and environmental research, fusion and plasma science, particle physics, and isotope-related R&D. More than half of the allocation, $22 million, is funded by the 2022 fiscal year budget. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to some of our general news stories. Raleigh firm buys Bald Head Island Ferry in $67 million deal, written by Lauren Onasorge. Nearly 40 years after a businessman purchased Bald Head Island's unsold land, a Raleigh firm is acquiring what remains of it, including the sole ferry system that connects the community to the mainland. Raleigh-based Sharpview Capital has reached a deal with Bald Head Island Limited to acquire the remaining Mitchell family operations and associated real estate assets relating to the island, including the ferry and tram system that connects to Southport. The $67.7 million deal was disclosed May 31. Also included in the acquisition is the tug and freight barge operation and Deep Point parking facility in Southport. "We've assembled a group of investors specifically for this transaction," says Lee Roberts, managing partner at Sharpview. Baldhead Island is a ferry-accessed golf cart community just 2 miles off the coast. Of the island's 12,000 acres, 10,000 have been committed to stay undeveloped. Texas billionaire George P. Mitchell purchased the island's unsold land out of receivership in 1983 and made a commitment to sustainability. That commitment included abandoning a developer's plan to build a second golf course on the island and instead dedicate 200 acres as a preserve. The Mitchell family is also credited with the decision to forego building a bridge to the mainland and instead rely on ferry access. Baldhead Island Limited had previously planned to sell the ferry system to a state entity that formed in 2017 to facilitate the sale of the assets. But there was pushback over the valuation of the ferry operation, which led to a years-long delays for those plans. Robert says discussions about the Sharpview deal had gone on for a while. While Sharpview is known for traditional real estate investments, such as the $41.7 million flip of the commercial complex that's home to the North Carolina Education Lottery, it has done infrastructure deals before. It was part of the Waste Industries transaction and has done wastewater treatment deals, Robert says. When the deal closes, nothing should change for ferry passengers. Roberts expects a seamless transition as the current management team stays in place. Over time, we hope we can put into place some technological upgrades and operational efficiencies, he says. The deal closes in stages. Everything but the ferry and tram system should close soon, but the ferry and tram system, as they're regulated, must meet the approval of the North Carolina Utility Commission. Raleigh apartments double in price in 1 year. A Dallas real estate investment firm has purchased an apartment community in North Raleigh with a price tag that spiked in recent years. Expedition Capital Advisors, or XCAP, bought the 152-unit Linwood Park apartment townhomes for $34.6 million, or $227,600 per unit, according to Wake County deed records. The property is located at 6200 North Hills Drive, just off Lynn Road. The seller is Willow Creek Partners of Reston, Virginia. Willow Creek purchased the apartments in April 2021 for $17.2 million, from Brookview Realty Group of Uniondale, New York. Brookview paid $14.5 million for the property in 2018. The Triangle has seen rents soar since 2020, and investors have paid high prices to acquire properties. Built in 1981, Linwood Park has one- and two-bedroom units ranging from 580 to 1,150 square feet. The property has 10 three-story apartment buildings and is within walking distance of Shelley Lake. Before the sale, XCAP had only two properties in the southeast. It now has more than 65 investments, with about 70% of them in the southwest. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Tech and Travel page, written by Lauren Onasorge. IBM Red Hat have bold ambitions for space. Red Hat IBM technology blasts off with SpaceX. When a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket launched in May, it was carrying an experiment led by IBM using Red Hat technologies. The effort is IBM's Endurance CubeSat mission, powered by open source, hybrid cloud, and AI technologies from both IBM and Red Hat. The goals are to provide a fast and easy way to process data in space, as well as open up outer space to anyone, including students. The stakes are high, says Naeem Atlef, Chief Technology Officer of Space Tech at IBM. He says work on the software-equipped Cube satellites being launched started almost 2 years ago. The goal is to democratize access to space, Altef says. As you know, it's only for a few privileged countries in the world, he says. We thought we could make it accessible to anyone, basically, with a hybrid cloud platform. Red Hat was integral to the project, Altef says. The team had to create a smaller version of its Kubernetes platform instead of OpenShift, think MicroShift. We needed something that would take less resources, he says. Developers from across the globe, including in Raleigh, contributed to the project. Altef sees endless commercial opportunities, but IBM is starting with schools. Someday, he envisions typical satellites will be software-defined, acting as software-as-a-service access to specialized sensors will be open to anyone, no specialized hardware required. It makes microgravity experiments possible without advanced aerospace knowledge. IBM's next acquisition likely to be smaller. Nearly 3 years after IBM's blockbuster $34 billion deal for Raleigh-based Red Hat, Big Blue continues to scout for deals, just not necessarily record breakers. M&A is something we're always looking at. Rob Thomas, IBM Senior Vice President of Global Markets, told analysts at J.P. Morgan's 50th Annual Global Technology, Media, and Communications Conference recently, "What happens any given month or quarter in the market doesn't really change the philosophy. We're always looking at M&A to drive growth, to fill in portfolio gaps, whatever those may be, and that's what we'll continue to do." But Logan Perk, an analyst with Edward Jones, says not to expect another Red Hat deal, at least not anytime soon. As far as M&A, he expects smaller tuck-in deals that either add some capabilities to their platform or bring in some consulting expertise. "I just think it's a challenge for them to make bigger deals just because I don't think they have the balance sheet capacity to do it right now." Firm in dental biz launches $2 million raise. A Durham startup aiming its software at the outdated dental industry is looking to raise $2 million. Cure Mint, whose technology is intended to help dental organizations grow faster using an automated all-in-one procurement platform, has so far raised $550,000 in debt financing from three investors, according to a securities filing dated May 20. But even as he makes his pitches, CEO Brandon McCarty knows sky-high valuations are correcting, making fundraising that much more challenging. Median valuations for public software companies have seen a 60% decline, dropping from 12 times forward revenue to 5 times or less since their peak last fall, according to Andreessen Horowitz's Future publication. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Andrew Levy, CEO of Avelo Airlines, on whether more routes could be on the way after it launched a single flight to New Haven, Connecticut in May. "It depends on how it goes. We start with one to our base up in Connecticut. Hopefully it does as well as we think it will. We feel very optimistic in our ability to have a very successful route, and of course, success drives more opportunities." And finally, a big number, $5 million. The fundraise announced by RepView, a Chapel Hill tech startup led by Channel Advisor veteran Ryan Walsh. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page, written by Zach Ezone. UNC lands grant to battle future viruses. UNC wants to create oral antivirals to slow any pandemics ahead. UNC Chapel Hill has secured a $65 million federal grant to establish a center focused on developing oral antivirals that can combat pandemic-level viruses such as COVID-19. The funding for the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health is part of $577 million the National Institutes of Health has awarded to establish 9 antiviral drug discovery centers throughout the U.S. The centers will research antivirals for COVID-19 and antivirals targeting other viral families with the high potential to cause a pandemic. "Decades of prior research on the structure and vulnerabilities of coronavirus has greatly accelerated our response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and we hope that similar research focused on antivirals will better prepare us for the next pandemic," said Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, which is part of the NIH. The money builds upon an effort UNC launched in 2020 called Rapidly Emerging Antiviral Drug Development Initiative, or READY. This is a global public-private partnership with the goal of developing antiviral drugs that could be effective against entire families of emerging viruses. The initiative landed $18 million in state funding earlier this year and received $5 million from RTI International last year. This funding supports the initiative's goal of raising $500 million over 5 years. The initiative is also aiming to have 5 drugs ready for phase 1 testing within 5 years. The effort includes collaboration with private firms. This year, Ready and Durham-based Chimerix shared what they described as promising early results for a program called CMX-521. The preclinical program is being studied as a COVID-19 treatment. Ready has built a coalition of scientists focused on developing antiviral drugs against pandemic virus threats, said Ralph Barrick, program director. To achieve these goals, our NIH-sponsored Ready AVID Center is an international consortium that includes academic institutions, pharmaceutical companies, and affiliated entities across five nations who work together to prevent life-threatening human coronavirus, flavivirus, alphavirus, and filovirus infections, Barrick said. UNC is the second largest NIH funding recipient in North Carolina and among the top 20 in the country. Raleigh healthcare startup rebrands as strategy shifts. Amid a change in its commercial operations, a Raleigh medical device startup is undergoing a rebranding. UVision 360 said May 18 that it would operate under the name Luminel to better reflect its product platform and pipeline. The company develops a modular endoscopic system called Luminel aimed at advancing women's healthcare. Luminel is also embarking on a new strategy. In 2020, it signed a distribution agreement with Olympus Medical Systems Group, but after some reshaping of its divisions, the distributor terminated the Luminel agreement and bought out the contract, CEO Allison London Brown says. We're figuring out how to do this on our own, she says. In building out its own distribution operations, Luminel began with adding a vice president of commercial development position to the company of five people. Luminel hired Lynn Moore to fill this position. She has more than 13 years of sales and distribution experience in the scientific equipment, instrumentation, and lab consumables market. NC State ranks number 7, Duke 15 in tech transfer. NC State University is the top higher education institution in North Carolina in turning research into economic output, according to a recent report from an economic-focused nonprofit. Heartland Forward created the report called Research to Renewal, Advancing University Tech Transfer. Through various metrics evaluating which universities best create knowledge, embed it within their graduates, and transfer it to new and existing enterprises. Heartland is an Arkansas-based nonprofit focused on improving the economic performance of the central United States. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Josh Parker, CEO and founder of Durham real estate firm Ancora, on the company's strategy of developing life sciences real estate near anchor institutions such as universities and hospitals. Everything we're doing nationally is based on our experience in the Durham market. And finally, a big number, $35 million, the amount Targan, a Morrisville biotech, has raised as it prepares to commercialize a system that uses high-speed imaging, artificial intelligence, robotics, and microfluidics to individually vaccinate up to 100,000 chicks per hour. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Brumette. Advance Auto sees promise in tough time. Raleigh Auto Retailer sees net sales increase in the first quarter. Advance Auto Parts saw some positives in the first quarter of 2022 despite macroeconomic headwinds. The auto parts retailer headquartered in Raleigh had an increase of 1.3% in net sales during the quarter ending April 23, reaching $3.4 billion, but still missed expectations. The company saw year-over-year growth in the company's professional and independent businesses. CEO Tom Greco said during an earnings call May 24. In summary, we believe that industry drivers of demand, including increasing car parts, improving miles driven, and over 5 million new vehicles in the sweet spot, remains positive to the industry over the long term, Greco said. At the same time, we are cognizant of external headwinds such as broad-based inflation and rising fuel prices. The first earnings report of 2022 came after Advance Auto saw a record year in 2021, with sales reaching $11 billion. For Advance Auto, stimulus in 2021 benefited its core do-it-yourself customers. Rising fuel costs were also a concern for the company, but new strategic pricing capabilities helped offset the effects. Our industry has proven to be resilient despite substantial cost inflation across commodities, fuel, and wages, Greco said. In particular, the professional business in auto parts has a different economic model than traditional retail. Comparable store sales increased by 0.6% and gross profit increased by 1.5%. Operating income saw a decline of 19.4% to hit $203.3 million, while the adjusted figure increased 1.6% to $303.6 million. The company also returned $403 million in cash to shareholders during the period. Advanced Auto saw same SKU inflation increase by 7.1% during the quarter, which was higher than expected, Chief Financial Officer Jeff Shepard said. In addition, higher wages and fuel costs within the supply chain are also working to offset gains the company is seeing from ongoing initiatives. Labor shortage woes have also caused a rise in store payroll. Historic Raleigh Hotel opens new bar. The historic Heights House Hotel, located on a pre-Civil War property in Raleigh's Boylan Heights neighborhood, is opening a bar. The small luxury hotel opened last year with owners Sarah and Jeff Shepard completed renovations of the Italianate mansion. The hotel's bar, known as The Parlor at Heights House, opened June 1, meaning non-hotel guests can experience the National Historic Landmark. The bar's menu will feature Italian-inspired cocktails meant to celebrate the spirit of the home, along with Italian wines, local craft beer, and charcuterie boards. Raleigh native Will Bryant, formerly of Charlotte's Fin and Fino, will serve as manager and mixologist. The parlor will be a reservation only for groups of up to six on Sunday, as well as Tuesday through Thursday. The house, originally called Montford Hall, was completed in 1860. Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream set to open shop. The much-anticipated opening of Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams in Durham is finally here. The ice cream shop is located in Brightleaf Square at 908 West Main Street and is now open. The brand, based in Columbus, Ohio, announced its move into Durham over a year ago. Jenny's is known for unique flavors such as Brambleberry Crisp, Blackout Chocolate Cake, and celebrity-inspired flavors including Dolly Parton's Strawberry Pretzel Pie. The Scoop Shop is the Triangle's first. Charlotte has three locations of the brand. Jenny's also sells pints in local grocery stores, including Whole Foods, Harris Teeter, and Target. And in a section called He Said It, a quote from Scott Arkin, CEO of Raleigh-based Orduo. The company recently launched its white label restaurant online ordering system, which allows resellers to have fully branded ordering platforms for restaurant clients. The technology opens doors and increases revenue for the reseller across the board. And finally, we have a notable number, $6. That's how much tickets will sell for when Paragon Theaters opens and carries Fenton Development July 1. Paragon Theater CEO Mike Whalen says low prices are part of the company's strategy to bring in more customers and rely on a diversified revenue stream. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, What Triangle's Rise in Home Sales Listings Means. I was dropping off a friend of mine in her neighborhood in Cary and noticed at least four homes with for sale signs in the yard. I asked her if something was going on in her neighborhood, and she replied that she hadn't noticed one for sale sign in her neighborhood in the past couple of years. With home values in some areas in Raleigh and Durham up more than 50% in the past 2 years, could it be that homeowners are finally ready to cash in their gains, even if that means moving out of the area? Are we in the middle of a FOMO, fear of missing out syndrome? Yes, we are. Stacy Anfinson, who tracks and analyzes the Triangle real estate market data, will come out with his May data in the next few days, which is expected to show a big jump in home listings in several Triangle neighborhoods. But it is nowhere close to the healthy market demand and supply, Anfinson points out, adding demand will continue to outpace supply because of economic tailwinds in the Raleigh-Durham area. Nationwide, home listings are spiking, too. Realtor.com came out with a report stating the supply of homes for sale jumped 9% in May. And Redfin's recent report states the number of homes for sale almost doubled in the 4 weeks ended May 15 when compared to the same time last year. So if home buying activity is slowing down because of higher mortgage rates, stricter lending standards, and stratospheric prices of homes, a boost in supply should likely bring home prices down, right? No. And that's where lies the devil in the details. Demand for homes, primarily in the $300,000 to $600,000 range, is so high that no amount of new homes and existing homes for sale is going to have a measurable effect on prices yet. At best, the percentage increase in average home prices likely will decelerate. The buzzword in housing these days is price deceleration. For the better half of 3 years, we have been hearing that while people would love to cash in the sudden appreciation of their homes, they would not have anywhere to go other than to leave the area. But now, many in their 40s and 50s are beginning to run the numbers to determine the cost of staying put and just being house rich on paper. There is a growing fear among many that the forced monetary policy from the Federal Reserve to deliberately cool down the U.S. economy will soon have a dilatory effect on companies whose earnings have been on a tear in recent quarters. The fear is, as profits start eroding, the companies will slow down hiring, and in certain industries, mass layoffs may well be on their way. Reviewing the recent financials from some of the nation's largest retailers, such as Walmart and Target, may add fuel to the pessimism. But unlike in 2008 and 2009, housing will not be the centerpiece of economic calamity, if there is one. When the average price-earnings ratio of S&P 500 companies is touching 23, we should have a correction. It reminds me of the words of former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, "irrational exuberance." For now, however, homeowners will soon have a choice to make: cave in to the FOMO syndrome or wait it out with a steel resolve that triangle home prices will continue their northward journey for at least the next couple of years. Decision time. And for our final article, investor joins Durham Project, global player partners on luxury high-rise in the Bull Cities downtown, written by Cliff Barnes. An international investment firm with U.S. headquarters in New York has bought into a luxury high-rise coming to downtown Durham. Global Holdings Management Group has partnered with Austin Lawrence Partners, a real estate development firm leading work on The Novus, a 27-story tower planned for 400 West Main Street. Austin Lawrence Partners, with offices in Durham and Aspen, Colorado, announced plans for The Novus in October 2021 and recently broke ground on the project. Initially, the company was going it alone on the development, but was always open to a partner and found it when Global Holdings approached them. Global Holdings specializes in large office buildings, hotels, and luxury residential developments in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Europe, with more than 10 million square feet of real estate, including more than 100 properties and 2,500 hotel rooms. Global's multifamily division currently comprises more than $1 billion in assets. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.